Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Phoebe S. K. Young. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Colorado Boulder, and we're talking about her new book, Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life, from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. Phoebe, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
How did you come to this story? Because this, we were talking about this off mic. There are only a few books that really surprised me in and apparently the subject I knew nothing about. I thought I knew something about it, but I really didn't. How did you get to this subject?
Well, it surprised me too, Mark. I started out writing a book just about recreational camping to see kind of what that could tell us about how people recreated in the outdoors. And in the process of writing the book, both, you know, the Great Recession and then the Occupy movement kind of burst onto the scene and made me really rethink what camping was about. And that found its way into the book. It made the book take a little bit longer to finish, but I think it did end up being a more surprising and interesting.
Fascinating. The book opens in January 2012 with the director of the National Park Service, Jonathan Jarvis, a witness before Capitol Hill. And there's an argument about what camping means. And when I read that, I was like, you got to be serious. But in fact, it is a real interesting debate.
Absolutely. And that moment when in open congressional hearing, you see the director of the Park Service as well as Congress people debating, what does it mean to camp? I knew I was on to something in that sense, that it was something that while appearing simple at first, once you start pulling those threads, just becomes more and more complex.
You write about that the book is about public nature and the social contract. Can you elaborate on what that means?
Absolutely. So, part of what I came to in doing this research during my time here in Boulder is about how camping, you know, why is it that camping speaks to us in ways that some other forms of outdoor recreation might not? And it's not to say that it's a better form or than other kinds of outdoor recreation that you might like or dislike. But whether you like or dislike, you know, camping for leisure, it comes to these kind of multiple dimensions, right, of functional and political that tap into core parts of American culture, of who we are and how we relate to nature and the nation and each other. And so public nature is, right, it's these spaces and stories about nature, about who can be in nature,
right,
what it means to us, right? And then sort of how do we relate to this kind of public space and beliefs about nature? And the social contract, right? I mean, that is right at the core of what are our beliefs about what we owe to each other and what the government owes to its citizens. And that, you know, given that the U.S. was founded on connection to the land, right, of attempts to create property, to mix your labor with the land, that was the basis of our social contract of government. And so then camping, in a way, becomes a different way to relate to the land, to connect to the land, to mix your leisure with the land.
The book starts during the Civil War and afterwards. And during the Civil War and afterwards, camping meant something very different. Talk to me about that.
So it's hard to, you know, look at sort of why people like to camp in the, you know, early part of the 19th century, because it's really much more of a functional kind of endeavor. It's what you did when you found yourself in between towns without indoor lodging. And so what you see in the Civil War era is camping starts to emerge as a kind of activity with meaning that has something, it has a broader import in American culture, whether that's from, you know, hundreds of thousands of men, you know, camping in a, you know, military style and then trying to make meaning of that experience in the after years and doing so as kind of veterans, as a part of reunion, as well as using camping as a way of reminding the nation of their service during the war and the years after. And so even though in this way it doesn't look at all like what we'd think of as recreational camping, it starts to acquire a certain kind of social meaning that it didn't have in the years before the Civil War, which allows other meanings like camping for fun to emerge.
Well, this section of the book really surprised me because, right, they were camping out. There were tents. As a matter of fact, there were several different kinds of tents that were illustrated. And then right after the Civil War, you know, there were different magazines or journals and stuff like that. People would relate stories about the Civil War, and, you know, the stories of the battles were all bloody. But then there started to come out these stories of men in camp. And it started to become sort of a romanticized notion that there was this idea of camaraderie, of sort of getting to know each other while they were in the Civil War in camp.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's a couple things going on there. The first is that, you know, camp and kind of anecdotes of camp life become a kind of safer way to share the war experience with the public than going over the bloody traumatic details. This, you know, war is traumatic in any era in that sense. And so you see that veterans sort of choosing to reminisce about camp life as opposed to talking about the brutal details in the battles. You see differences in their diaries at the time versus what they kind of have nostalgia for after the fact, right? And so then and it also becomes this way to create this identity of being a veteran, right? And so camping as part of your reunion is projecting a certain kind of vision of what particularly, and I looked particularly at the Union Army, and so those veterans as kind of positioning themselves as the men who saved the Union, and they did it while they were the boys in camp. And that's kind of how, by reenacting that identity, it was reminding the nation of the struggle and who were the victors.
And these vision of these tents, these sort of, and they're all crowded in, by the way, they're not like tenting now. The Grand Army of the Republic, camps become a selling point for that veterans organization. You know, they weren't doing so well until they started promoting the camping.
Absolutely, right? So it's in this way mixing a certain kind of nostalgia, a leisure activity, right, to come and camp out with your, you know, your old war buddies and to do that. And that it becomes this way of, as you say, kind of recreating that sense of camaraderie and idealizing a certain sense of egalitarianism, right, between the men in the camp, that it was a kind of new vision of what sort of citizens, even at a time, you know, ironically, when classes are starting to divide even greater than they ever have before.
Yeah, well, race is the big issue throughout the early days of camping, totally.
Absolutely. So, I mean, certainly when you look at this vision, it's very conflicted, and the Grand Army of the Republic is such an interesting veterans organization in that it was actually race blind and did not officially have a color line and welcomed black veterans, and there were integrated kind of local groups, posts they called them. There were also some sort of black-led posts of the GAR. And so in that sense, you can see that kind of ability or the inkling that you could spread that sense of egalitarian soldiers' camaraderie across racial bounds. But it starts to get sort of run afoul of rising Jim Crow laws in the South when Northern veterans go down and are the sort of prohibitions on integrated spaces are so strict that the GAR itself starts to sort of divide over how to handle the race issue. And in the end of the day, even though they're still officially committed to sort of cross-race equality, that there ends up being a de facto color line and that they don't promote black veterans as much as we might have liked in hindsight. But still, they're just a unique and interesting organization that way.
Early on, and we're talking about the late 1800s, the public, the non-veteran public, starts to think about camping. Now they're thinking about camping as building an outdoor community, and there are these books. I'd love to pick up a copy of these books, like How to Camp Out, Hints for Camping and Walking, which was published in 1877. But they have an idea that what you're not just camping out to enjoy nature, you're camping out to sort of build an alternative community.
Yes. So it's less about what we might think of as kind of escape or communing, connecting with nature in an unmediated way. But a lot of those early recreational campers were about, reconstituting a community. Some of them maybe about what we might think of as alternative communities of you know, mini utopias. Yeah. But in lots of ways, the attraction was very much to just setting up house in the wilderness, right? Of being able to recreate the comforts of home in this kind of rustic, natural setting. And so people were attracted to that idea of kind of that this was both for family life as well as for different communities, was a kind of way to have an ideal kind of group experience.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Phoebe S.K. Young. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Colorado Boulder. And we're talking about her new book. I'll tell you, this will open your eyes about how we think about camping. Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. Let's talk about John Muir, because that was sort of, I think a lot of people sort of know about John Muir. But his story in regards to this tale about camping is really important. There's basically two trips in John Muir's life. One is to the South and one is to the West, which comes later. Let's talk about his trip to the South.
All right.
Camping for John Muir at that point was not a good thing.
Absolutely, right? So this is kind of before John Muir becomes famous, as sort of he takes his first long walkabout in the, you know, immediate aftermath of the Civil War, 1867. He's wandering around the South, which is a kind of interesting image on its own. But literally, he takes this 1,000-mile walk through Kentucky and Georgia and Florida, and he tried to avoid sleeping outside as much as he could. Right? He mostly disliked camping. He found it lonely. He much preferred to knock on the door of strangers and ask to sleep on their floor.
I found that really scary. To just knock on a stranger. But he actually said that he would rather do that than sleep outside.
Absolutely. And there were a couple of instances when he enjoyed sleeping outside, most famously in Savannah's Bonaventure Cemetery, which is the one made famous in the midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And it was a beautiful spot, and he kind of gloried in it. But that's also probably where he contracted malaria. that kind of ended his long walk to the South a couple weeks later by sleeping, you know, near the kind of swampy area that the cemetery was located.
He had a fear of former slaves, too. And that was not just him. That was a lot of people. There was this fear that slaves, the black people that were no longer slaves, were sort of roaming in these wild bands and were going to come down on fellow travelers. He also feared alligators were going to get him. You also had some weird drawings that you reproduce in the book. Those are strange looking.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so interesting to look at the original diary where those are. I think they give a sense of, you know, in conjunction with the words that he writes of kind of what his vision is of how, you know, how he sits within nature. And honestly, I mean, we think of John Muir as this kind of titan, fearless guy who will climb sequoia trees in a thunderstorm. But the images really show him as kind of vulnerable a little bit, you know, fearful of what nature might hold for him.
So he catches malaria. He goes back home and, you know, to cure. And then he takes a trip out west, and it's like a different person.
So he you know, convalesces from malaria, has a brief visit back north, and then, sails across, you know, to Panama, across there into California, and finds kind of what he was looking for in this accommodating climate. Nature all of a sudden became kind of more comforting and safe in California. And, you know, part of that we can attribute to the difference in the physical environment itself, right? The South in the summer, you know, can be a hot, humid place to be, whereas, you know, California, the clear air there, and, you know, a lot of people had already been coming to the West for the dry air and the climate. So we can attribute part of that. But I think a lot of it also came to be in his own kind of intellectual approach to the outdoors, and how he slowly began to find himself more at home in the outdoors, and how he defines what that means as kind of different than how he felt in the South, as kind of adrift and alone, is a key part of how he discovers, ironically, you know, to feel at home also allows him to feel like camping is a restorative way of connecting with nature.
There's one monkey wrench in this, and that's Native Americans.
Absolutely.
He had a an interesting view about the people who actually live there.
Right. So, I mean, one of the interesting things about this sort of his way of approaching the outdoors is that he was very ascetic about it. You know, he thought that the kind of most civilized, enlightened way to really understand and be in nature was to not affect nature, right? So he would, you know, known for walking through the woods for days with just a kind of, you know, moldy hunk of cheese and maybe a half a loaf of bread, and that no equipment, no tent, right? And so...
Oh, yeah, he makes a big deal about lying on flowers and boughs and of trees and stuff like that. So he really is going the ascetic route.
Absolutely. And so he looks at indigenous people who are kind of living with nature, right, and sort of practicing horticulture, being kind of interdependent, living off the land. And he can see that they're doing that. And he says to himself, I really should learn to live like the Indians. But he didn't. And he never really tried to figure out how to, you know, make acorn mush or collect the roots and berries that the indigenous people in the Yosemite Valley particularly, you know, had as sort of part of their diet. And so he develops a kind of disdain for that, the sort of interdependent way of life that kind of writes indigenous people out of what had truly been their home before he discovered it as home.
Yeah, so they were in the way of his spiritual enlightenment. Yeah, of course.
Now, this vision of kind of pristine wilderness. Yeah,
that's right. It's minus the people who live there. People are starting to write more about camping. And again, I'm really fascinated by these books like 10 Summers Under Canvas in 1887. Mm-hmm. And so people are starting to, again, think about going out into the out of doors. And the equipment was very, very basic at the time. But I think the weird thing is they wanted to avoid looking like tramps. There was this tramp problem. And I find that so strange. But were there a ton of tramps walking around and then people wanted to avoid looking like them?
So, I mean, the numbers of people that, you know, were classified as tramps, right? Mobile laborers or those trying to avoid labor in the late 19th century, early 20th century when, you know, the economy is kind of, you know, chaotic. Going between boom and bust times. And so there were a lot of out-of-work people periodically, and they moved around. But the numbers themselves weren't, I can't give you an exact number, but they weren't a kind of massive segment of the population. It was a fairly steady but fluctuating number of folks. But the alarm, the kind of social alarm about what these people represented was well out of proportion to their actual numbers. And so the discourse around how to make sure people knew you were camping for leisure and you weren't one of these menacing tramps who, you know, might be, you know, anarchists or strikers or disrupting society, that so there was a lot of discussion in these early periodicals, like, you know, basically the precursors to Outside Magazine are discussing this of how to avoid being mistaken for one of these kind of sort of socially marginalized figures.
So in the beginning, they recommended sort of going well-heeled.
Right.
So that sort of seems so weird when we think about camping now that you would actually go and make sure that you look really like you're on the economic up and up.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you can sort of, you know, see that today as sort of the connection.
Oh yeah, it's gone back to glamping. Yeah.
Having the latest gear, right? The coolest North Face tent, and that, you know, all of these things, that those discussions among campers about gear, it's evolved for sure. But yeah, camping was not promoted in its early days as being an economical vacation choice.
One of the things they aim for is transforming outdoor space into a domestic space. So they're still not looking at I'm trying to get one with nature. They're essentially moving their domestic space outside.
Yeah, and there were key differences in that sense, is that they did, you know, recognize that they were out in the wilderness, and they talked about how much they enjoyed going without their shoes and not having to have the same kind of fancy table manners. And women talked about what a relief it was to not wear their corsets, in camp, right? So they definitely took, you know, had a certain sense about how these outdoor spaces gave them a certain kind of license to experiment with things they never would have done back in the city.
Well, what you how you talk about it is that it actually sheds light on domestic sexual stereotype relationships. I mean, gender roles in camp were really an interesting issue at this time.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think part of that sense that it was a space apart where they were both trying to reconstitute their households, but it was not in the city. It was not subject to the same kind of sort of social expectations, allowed people to experiment. And you really do see gender roles, particularly, or family roles more broadly, come to the fore and negotiating, like, was it okay for women to go without corsets? Was it okay for women to hunt while they were camping, you know, and how, you know, who did the work of camp, right? And how that played out in these little sort of camping households. What I would look to me is kind of on this cusp of you know, the 20th century of modern family life that you start to see emerge more in the 1920s and the 30s, that this was kind of a way of trying it out, auditioning those different kinds of roles.
Now, there was an assumption by people, these temporary campers, that they had permission to camp on open land. In other words, they didn't have to ask.
Right. So the assumption was that, yeah, basically, you know, you could camp on any open space unless somebody told you not to. Whether it was a private land, you know, that you could camp on a farm, like on the edge of a farm, or whether it was just public undeveloped land. Well, you know, in the late 19th century, we start to see some, you know, reserves, the Adirondacks, right? We start to see a few national parks come in early on. But this is generally, you know, when people go camping, they are not in a very, you know, the kind of space they're in is not always very clear. They see a good meadow and they camp there, unless somebody comes along and says, you know, you can't really stay here, so my property, I don't want you here. People just assume that they could, you know, stay temporarily in those spots.
You know, eventually, especially during the Depression particularly, but there were a lot of mobile workers who were camping out by necessity on their way to, say, California from the Dust Bowl. And so these were really mobile workers who would also just look for any open space to pitch a tent for the night.
Right. And so while this was a very common kind of assumption throughout the 19th century, you know, whether you were John Muir or these recreational campers or tramps, right, you know, whether you're doing this for functional reasons or recreational reasons. In the early 20th century, that starts to change. And as more spaces become very clearly designated for recreational camping, it makes kind of the assumption that you can camp anywhere you want more dicey, right? And particularly depends on who you were. And so this, you know, there's still this dialogue of looking like a tramp or not. And so migrants, right, particularly from, you know, the Dust Bowl, ran into this head on, right, when they would try to camp by the side of the road. And all of a sudden that became a more policed space where localities would try to keep the migrants from, you know, staying and sort of try to keep them moving on and, you know, literally sort of from the margins of the roadside itself.
There's a person in your book who I found really fascinating. That's Emilio Meineke.
Mm-hmm.
People started just by the 1920s, 1930s, it sounds like camping just took off as an idea. And things like the Coleman stove and all sorts of special equipment was now being designed for camping. And people were flocking to the national parks and to, you know, national forests. And it was sort of a disaster that they were like just going everywhere because there was no assigned place for them to go. And they were just actually really destroying the land by going out and camping.
Right. loving it to death, as we say. You know, and it's something that the, you know, national parks, national forests have been dealing with for a long time. But yeah, in the 1920s, particularly with the automobile becoming more mass produced and available to those beyond just the upper classes, drove the popularity of outdoor recreation and camping in particular way up very quickly over the course of the 1920s and just completely overwhelmed the park agency's ability to handle this increase in visitors. And indeed, they sort of went everywhere they want. They staked their tents to the roots of giant sequoia trees. They roiled streams by washing their dishes in them and were basically menaces to these spaces.
But then Emilio Meineke comes, and he actually starts designing campgrounds. And what's amazing about that is I still see campgrounds designed that way.
Absolutely. So Meineke designed what, you know, I call, we think of as the loop campground, right?
Yep,
you
get
spot 12 on loop B, right? And it indeed, it was a bureaucratic sensation in the early 1930s to address this problem of sort of campers camping kind of willy-nilly wherever they wanted. And so it became, in the big era of, you know, infrastructure development, right, the New Deal era, and it became the blueprint for basically every campground that the Conservation Corps or other agencies built during the 1930s and then in the 40s and 50s as well. And so it's still today is kind of the one that you most often see.
And I can talk about campgrounds right near where I am right now that are designed exactly on that loop road and campsites. And he wanted to design campsites not too close together. He wanted to give them some breathing space in between.
Yeah, so he built on this kind of vision of, you know, campers setting up their own little household, and so wanted each campsite to be, you know, spacious enough to have all of the kind of accoutrements that you would expect, a picnic table, a driveway, a fire ring, those kinds of things that you could kind of set up your house there. He thought of it as it should be a roofless cabin is what he called it, to try to encourage people to make themselves at home and not damage all the things that surrounded their home.
We're completely out of time, and there's so much more to talk about in this book. It's a fascinating history. My guest tonight has been Phoebe S.K. Young. She is a associate professor of history at the University of Colorado Boulder, and we're talking about her book, Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. Phoebe, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It has been for me as well.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.